Well, hey everyone, did you know AudiophileUSA.com is still open and still shipping records worldwide? That's right, AudiophileUSA.com is a family-owned and operated online record shop that specializes only in excellent and near-mint vinyl records. Just go to AudiophileUSA.com and you are guaranteed satisfaction, as they only have excellent and near-mint vinyl records, some still in original factory shrink wrap, some even still sealed original store stock. AudiophileUSA.com has over 42,000 titles in stock and more arriving all the time, and they are shipping globally. I use them regularly and I suggest checking them out, especially in these times of not being able to leave the house. Just point your browser to AudiophileUSA.com and find your holy grail.
Hi, this is Paige Hamilton. You're listening to The Vinyl Guide.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Well, hey everyone, it's Nate here. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Look, I'm just going to smash right into it. This week we have Helmet founder, leader, songwriter, guitarist, riffmeister, and overall maniac Paige Hamilton on the show, and he's going to be walking us through Helmet history. Now, Paige and I spoke at length about a great many things, and it was one of those conversations where we had a good time talking records and music, and it really could have gone another 2 or 3 hours, I'm sure. In fact, what you are going to hear today is about half the conversation. The other half is up on our Patreon page, patreon.com/vinylguide. You can hear the other half up there. Today, Paige walks us through Helmet's history. I mean, it's an incredibly extensive period, going all the way back to the AMREP days, through their time on Interscope, and all the way to the present, with their latest LP, Dead to the World, as well as talking about current events, their current projects, their tours, and more. Now, just to be super clear, Paige and I recorded this conversation just before the world turned upside down and went COVID crazy, and Helmet's 30 by 30 tour was postponed, as well as their dates with Faith No More and various festivals they're part of. However, I'm very happy to see that the Helmet 30 by 30 dates have now been rescheduled. They're moving their Australian and New Zealand dates from May to November, which quite frankly is a much better time to be on this side of the planet. I also see that their other concert dates are also getting rescheduled. So head over to helmetmusic.com or facebook.com/helmetmusic for a full list of all their new dates and, of course, ticket links, vinyl merch, and more. And just to be clear, what I mentioned earlier, what you're hearing today on this episode is a little more than half the conversation. The full interview with Paige is available to our Patreon supporters at patreon.com/vinylguide. Become a supporter of the Vinyl Guide podcast at patreon.com/vinylguide and get early access to episodes, exclusive content, secret episodes, extended interviews, and more. And by the way, there's at least another 20 minutes of this conversation up there. Lots of talk about music theory, the art of songwriting. Paige walks us through writing some of his riffs, the origin of some of Helmet's most enduring songs, and more. All exclusively available to patrons of the show at patreon.com/vinylguide. So sign up now, support this show, and you'll be enjoying the extended interviews in seconds. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. And of course, you're always welcome to enjoy the other episodes of the Vinyl Guide podcast, including episode 210 featuring Jazz Coleman of Killing Joke, episode 214 with Chuck Billy of Testament, not only talking about the new album, but his recent bout of coronavirus and the effects on his million-dollar lungs. That's episode 214 of the Vinyl Guide. Episode 201 featuring Pepper Keenan of Corrosion of Conformity. Episode 184 featuring Glenn Matlock of Sex Pistols. Episode 178 featuring Richard Patrick of Filter. Episode 143 featuring Mark Evans of AC/DC and Rose Tattoo walking us through their vinyl catalogs. Episode 127 featuring James Williamson of Iggy and the Stooges, and heaps, heaps more. All available on Apple, iTunes, Spotify, thevinylguide.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. And that's it for the upfronts. Everyone, please enjoy this conversation with Paige Hamilton, and you can always hear the rest at patreon.com/vinylguide. And with that, let's start the Vinyl Guide interview with Paige Hamilton of Helmet. This week on The Vinyl Guide, we have Paige Hamilton of Helmet, a band who has probably put more earworms in my head than any other band. Paige, thanks for making the time to talk to us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What was music like in the Hamilton house growing up? Were there a lot of records?
Yeah, funny. Somebody asked me that the other day at the restaurant, Olio, we were playing at our friend Steve Costanza's, the chef, and he said, how did you get into jazz? And I said, Mom and Dad. Whenever they were having people over, it was a party night, they would put on Dixieland. And it always was like, this means it's Mom and Dad are going to be in a good mood, you know, because they're going to be, probably three sheets to the wind or whatever. But so this music meant it was going to be a good night and I could, you know, probably stay up later and whatever. So then, and my mom really liked George Shearing and they listened to Ella Fitzgerald. And I remember those, Dixieland, Ella, and George Shearing. That music, Errol Garner as well. My mom, the guy who wrote Misty, which is a phenomenal song. So that music was around and somehow just kind of, I think I absorbed it through osmosis. And then of course rebelled when I heard Led Zeppelin and I was like, that's what I want to do. And then I discovered the Tubes and they were, apoplectic when they found out that I was at the concert in Medford that, you know, the Tubes are now banned from Medford because of that concert in 1977. But
what's the story there? You know, what did they do to get themselves banned?
They had Ray Styles, you know, she was in the Quaalude. He had this couple of foot tall platforms and Quaalude and naked girls and the closed circuit TVs, cameras. And I was, of course, you know, gripping the front of the stage, just like, what? Oh, my God. It was, you know, White Punks on Dope and Boy Crazy and all that. Those first couple of Tubes albums were life changing for me. I mean, the first, even Tubes Now, you know, the one with Smoke, La Vie Fumée, I like those, but especially the first two.
General debauchery
paper. General debauchery, and it was the scantily clad women, bare-breasted women that I guess is why they were banned. And they had, I think I remember some sort of sex chain conveyor belt thing on the TV cam screens, you know. It was, I mean, low tech, you know, back then compared to what people have now. Like, you know, there wasn't a flat screen TV or whatever. But it was an awesome show musically for me. I love their songs and they were such a great band, such great players, you know, all of them.
That's interesting. The relationship that you and your family had with music. I do a lot of interviews here and I'll normally notice one of two different themes. One is music was my ticket out of here. I needed to leave. And the other was music was something that I watched my parents enjoy. And it's almost kind of like if you see your parents enjoying it, it really, especially as a young, in your young mind, it really forms this big impression on the power of music.
Yeah. And ironically though, when I came home flunking out of college and dad said, dad was splitting my first year with me. And, he said, that's it. You're on the academic probation. And he said, you're just, you know, horsing around up there. I mean, his words, fucking around. He's like, stop. He told me when I was pulling out of the driveway, don't be fucking around up there. That's what he said. And of course I went crazy. But when I came into his office and said, he said, well, I don't know, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to go to Lane Community College and study music. And he goes, bullshit. And I was like, yep. Why? Because I couldn't afford the university. But then I learned to read and study classical and jazz. And my teacher said, this is how you got to do it. And I did it. Then when I got, you know, a gold record and a Grammy nomination and my master's degree, and I gave all that to my parents and they couldn't have been more excited. So it was, You know, there was a, I remember my aunt, Annie Wanda, Aunt DeWanda, she happened to be there the night after that Tubes concert, by the way, and she was a very religious Episcopalian, Evercust or whatever. And she was like, you could go into the music business, you know? And I'm like, nah, I'm a musician. I want to play, you know? It's like, well, they have it at University of Oregon. You can do this business thing. I'm like, nope. Doesn't interest me, you know? So
she's trying to be a peacemaker.
Yeah. Practical, yeah. She's trying to be practical and stuff. But there was, yeah. So there was, you know, there were. They were upset when I told them that I'd been accepted at Manhattan School of Music and got a scholarship, and I was going to move to New York. It was just silence on the other end of the phone. But then at the end of the day, they came out for my master's graduation when I got my degree, and they couldn't have been more excited. So. It came around. I think they just wanted to see that I was applying myself to something besides, you know, being the Clark Walton champion beer chugger. You know, I think my 63 seconds on a spigot still stands. That record is probably, you know, like.
Well, it's nice. You made time for both. That's important.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So when you start bringing these records, the Led Zeppelin, the Tubes into the house, what were your parents' reaction to them?
I was always, I'm still like this, honestly. I'm self-conscious about playing music that I like and want to listen to in front of anybody else. You know, like on the tour bus, Stanier would always put music on. Henry was, you know, into Hank Williams and Saul Hu P.E. and John was listening to, you know, The Far Side and Square Pusher or whatever. And I just never really wanted to subject anyone to music I like, because I don't like my joy being taken away by someone else not enjoying themselves. And so it was kind of like that growing up for me. I had headphones. We had we got the Realistic stereo, you know, from Radio Shack. And I was the one that got to crawl under the, you know, worm and spider infested, you know, crawl space under the house and run the speaker wires. Dad drilled holes in the floor. And he's like, I'm over here. And, you know, hammering on the floor, and I'm crawling across the far end of the house and, you know, dragging the speaker and poking it up through the floor for him. But I would, you know, when they were watching Love Boat with my brother and sister, I was in the living room with the lights out and trying to figure out what the hell was going on with that keyboard part in the Light from Led Zepp, and just going, this is the most amazing stuff ever. But I've told this story a few times. It kind of dawned on me 10 years ago that I was a horse with no name when I was car sick in 1970, 71, and in the back of the station wagon. And brother and sister were up front, mom, dad in the very front, and I was car sick, and that song came on. And I just forgot about everything. I went inside that song, and it's like, to this day, it's one of the most amazing songs I've ever heard. And I still hear it and go, like, this cured me from car sickness, because I just went inside the music. You know, I realized it's kind of this point in my life, like, hey, you know, like I said, it sort of dawned on me many, many years later. That's the first time I remember, like diving inside and going, like, these, you know, these bongos and this 12 string and this dry bass and everything, trying to pick everything out in the music. And so that, you know, and my parents were cool. I mean, I saved up my money for the records, and I, you know, I had a job. It wasn't like they were giving me money so I could listen to whatever I wanted. I remember my dad asked me to put on Led Zeppelin once. We were, I think we might have been having some people come over, and we were sitting in the living room. And I was like, my parents are going to listen to Achilles' Last Stand with me, and like, this is going to be really weird. But they just, you know, it was kind of the similar experience to my mom asking me to play guitar, and I sat down to play this Napoleon Koss, this Rondo on classical guitar. And she lasted about 30 seconds and got up and started vacuuming. So it's like, you know, music was kind of background for them. It was entertainment. It was meant good times. It meant, you know, it wasn't something. My father, in fact, one time I came home and he was like, son, I want to play you this Yanni at the Acropolis. I think this, like, it's probably the kind of stuff you're studying at Manhattan School of Music. And I'm like, yeah, Dad, yeah, yeah. It's just, oh, this is great. Yeah, thank you so much. And I'm like, you know, I just thought it was endearing, you know, and sweet that he was interested, you know, now that I was a career musician or whatever. He wanted to connect with me. And I tell my band this all the time. One of my favorite ever JT Hamilton things. He's like, God, I think you'd just be great. Great up there as a front man. You know, you could be like, our bass player's really on tonight. He's got clean socks on. You know, I'm like, that's a great one, Dad. I'll use that. You know, so I'm like, so I still ask our bass, Dave. I'm like, you got clean socks on tonight, Dave? You going to play great? You know, just like, so great. And Danny, my other guitar player's dad, asked him, he's like, well, who owns the speakers? I'm just like, you're just like, yeah, well, yeah, they belong to the club. Yeah.
Oh, that's lovely. That's great. So they gave you your space, and they did their best to participate, even though sometimes they weren't sure exactly how, but that's nice. And,
yeah.
And they introduced you. That's where you got your lifelong love of Yanni, I imagine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But yeah. Can't. I've got the entire Yanni collection, Yanni at the Acropolis. Yeah. Collection. It's phenomenal. Yeah. Well, there were songs that stuck with me, like the Brothers Four, you know, it's Puff the Magic Dragon. There were kind of folky things that they would listen to. And, I think that kind of made, for some reason, I related to, Woody Guthrie, because my grandfather and grandmother on dad's side were born in Oklahoma. They were Okies, dust that came across to the West Coast from because of the Dust Bowl. And I heard Woody Guthrie talk on the Smithsonian collection and go, that's Grandpa Bones right there. And I played it for Dad, and he was like, oh, my God, sounds just like him, you know, when he was telling the story. Well, he looked at me kind of funny, and he came over there, and I had, and it's like, and so there was like something there, too, that connected for me, you know. And I mean, obviously, brilliant songwriter and you know, changed everything. But it's funny how your family influences you, you know, even you're trying to escape their influence as a teenager, you know. And I came back to jazz strong. I mean, obviously, there was a period where I was like, not Led Zeppelin, AC/DC, you know, Aerosmith when they were amazing, and you know, and I ended up, you know, God, I got a George Benson record, and I heard that guitar playing, and I was like, what is this? I've never heard this before. Like, that's, you know, it was that pop album, Breezin' from 76, and I got it from my mom, thought she would like it. And I remember hearing it and just going like, what the hell? How do you play the guitar like that? And that kind of just lit this fire under my ass.
Were you already playing guitar at that time, or was that kind of the
gateway? Yeah. I was playing guitar. Yeah, I was probably, and the album came out in 76. I got my first guitar at 17 in 77. So by the time I bought that for mom, I was probably 18 and had been playing for, you know, a year or less. But then I got a guitar teacher, and I wanted to learn Stairway to Heaven, and he said it was too difficult. So I fired him, and I got a guy named John Sorensen, who said, you like jazz? And I'm like, yeah, I like jazz. And I knew nothing. I knew mom had that George Benson record. I go, that's jazz, right? And it's like, kind of. I mean, he's one of the, as one of my teachers said to me when I was a little snot at 19, I'm like, ah, George Benson is a sellout. And he's like, shut the fuck up. He's like one of the greats that made it. You're not allowed. And I'm like, you're right. Absolutely. And I still actually at the jazz brunch, we did Hello Birdie, which is a 6/8 blues that he did. Like that's faster than snot and impossible. And he just shreds on it. It's amazing. But, I can acknowledge greatness, even though I don't love all the music that he did, you know?
So when this guitar teacher said, hey, you like jazz, and you said George Benson, he said, yeah. Did he then pull out what, like Grant Green or Kenny Burrell? Does that
exactly? Kind of it was Grant Green, Lazy Afternoon, as a matter of fact. And it was with that, which has the great Elvin Jones on drums. And he said, what time signature is this in? And I'm like, I was trying to count. And I'm like, God, is it in three? He's like, no. Well, it's not four. He's like, it's 5/4. I was like, what?
Four? The first number can be bigger?
Yeah, that's crazy. Oh, my God. You know, it's just like mind blowing. Actually, I said, you know, I said, you asshole to him. He's like, what are you doing? You know, I'm such an idiot. Like, I'm super, like, no filter. I was like, you asshole. He's like, shit, what are you I don't call me an asshole. I was like, I get so fired up and enthusiastic. You know, I call my teacher an asshole for playing me 5/4, you know. But yeah, such a great song. And Elvin, my God, come on. Mm-hmm. It's like Grant and Elvin together were just phenomenal.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, those Blue Note years, especially those early 70s Grant Green albums, Alive, amazing still to this day. Yeah.
Erzjan and Solid, you know, the Nigeria and Solid, the one with Erzjan on it. Those are just, those are must have albums. They're just, I transcribed Erzjan off that for my, my master's recital. It was one of the tunes I did. Yeah, just incredible. Really tricky song on the guitar written by Sonny Rollins, which it's probably tricky on the saxophone, but not quite as, you know, just that angular kind of, but really, really, really cool. Grant was phenomenal. I met Grant Green Jr., went to see him play in New York years ago. And with my dear friend whose house I'm at now in Connecticut, my buddy that we do these, I force him to do these jazz gigs with me. He was such a nice guy, and we were like, man, we love your father. He's like huge influence on us. So he was, Grant was amazing, man.
So Paige, look, I have a feeling that you and I could talk for a long, long time, but we haven't even gotten to the records yet. So
I know.
Let's kind of smash cut over there real quick.
Cool.
So Helmet starts. You start playing around, you get the attention of Tom Hazelmeyer at Amphetamine Reptile.
Yes.
How did that conversation start? And I believe you had a first single, Born Annoying. Was that kind of the first?
Born Annoying, yes.
Okay.
That was the first thing we put out, yeah. That was a fortunate situation. Peter Mangaday's wife or ex-wife was a good friend of our band. She's the one that hired me at Rockpool when I got fired from my job after going on tour with Band of Susans to stuff envelopes and write reviews under pen name, under fake names. She said she knew all these labels. She said, well, let's send stuff out to X, Y, and Z. So we sent it to Jill Faunus at Twin Tone. Jill's still a very dear friend of mine. She ended up working for our manager for years. And you know, she's like my sister. I just adore her. And she worked at Twin Tone, realized Helmet was way too over the top. But Hazelmeyer was sharing an office with Twin Tone at the time, handed him the demo tape. He phones. He's like, I love this. I want to put out Born Annoying. And the B-side is Rumble. The deal is 50-50. And here's how it goes. And it's because we'd already recorded it, obviously. So he played for the pressing and the artwork and all that stuff because we'd already paid for the recording, and that's how we started. He sent us a bunch of copies of the single. We went around to the various record stores in Manhattan and said, we'll sell these for $5 or whatever it was. And we sold out quickly and people started talking about the band. That's kind of how we got started. So
do you know how many were pressed? Do you know anything?
My guess is 500 max. Might have been less, that's my guess. I mean, you know, back then, obviously there was, you know, it was all vinyl, 7 inches where we all had 7 inches and 12 inches and 10 inches. And, you know, there were no CDs yet in 89 that I remember. Right. I don't think so. Yeah.
Right on the cusp there. And I noticed on the record, there's an umlaut above the M.
Yeah.
What was thinking on that?
I was a bartender on First Avenue and First Street at a place called The Levee, and we had these great customers. And one of them, and I'm going to forget his name, Nick, he hosted in East Orange, Uppsala College, the great station that used to play our kind of music, and he actually had us on the show once. We were joking about like the metal thing with umlauts. He's like, and he said, oh my God, it'd be hilarious to put the umlaut over the M. And I speak German. I studied classical guitar in Germany, and I was like, perfect. I love it. So yeah, it was one of the early, you know, silly things. But that was Nick. It's going to drive me crazy. We could find out. He hosted the radio show for years, years and years. And then he played in the living room at Uppsala College at the in East Orange. Yeah, it was really cool.
Yeah, because phonetically it's impossible to have an umlaut above a consonant.
Makes no sense. Yeah, right. Yeah. No, it's supposed to be over vowels. Yeah.
Okay. Like, that's the
mix it. Yeah.
The one thing yeah. I remember from school. So the success of that single, I believe, then kind of gatewayed into Stick It In.
Yeah, we had been Hazelmyer then came to to New York. We said, I want you guys to open up for Boss Hogg and Halo Flies. And we had already recorded about half of Strap It On. And he said, Peter Davis, who was started booking us, Creature Booking, worked with Tom. He said, you know, just when Tom sees you play live, he's going to want to put out a record. So what do you have? And I said, well, we've recorded, saved up my bartending tips, and we recorded one side. That's how we did it back then. You save up your bartending tips and recorded side one of Strap It On. And by the time, you know, another few months had passed, then he said, yeah, you got enough for an album? I said, yep, we do. So that then Strap It On came out, and that was distributed by Rough Trade, which went under, and there were some issues. And so the minute it came out, I think there were a bunch of copies sitting on a floor of a warehouse in San Francisco, and it was out of print. So and the demand, then the band just exploded. We started playing live. We went to Europe and came back, and next thing we knew, everyone was throwing $1 million at us. The first one was like, we'll give you $10,000 in a van. I'm like, sounds good.
Beach bartending. You
know? Yeah. And then somebody said, and Hazelmyer said, you know what? You need to have somebody help you with this. Cause he said, I can't deal with all these labels. So he couldn't deal. Like his label was getting bombarded. And he's not that wasn't his thing. His thing was a small, you know, label run by him and, you know, Pat Dwyer and Mike Wolf, you know, his three dudes or whatever. They weren't going to handle the helm of things. So said, you got to go to a major label. So that was what we did.
Even when you went to Interscope, Meantime and Betty were, the vinyl copies were put out on Amphetamine Reptile, I believe. Was that a prearranged thing?
Sure. I know Strap It On, they bought Strap It On, but I think we did arrange something for AMREP to, yeah, we worked out some kind of deal with AMREP so he would release the vinyl. I'm not sure. I guess I would have been Meantime for sure then. I don't remember with Betty. We did a double 10-inch. I know
exactly.
That. Really cool.
Yeah, double 10-inch was on AMREP, and I believe there were some extra songs and then some missing songs off that. Do you remember the conversation around that?
No, I don't remember why we had to leave certain songs off, and I was and why there were like Pariah or other songs that were included on the vinyl release. I mean, part of the thing was, I think that it was cool to make the CD and the album versions different. Back then, it was kind of still the early days of CDs, and it was like, you need more songs. I'm like, why? Like, you know, Love Supreme is, you know, 25 minutes long. It's one of the greatest albums ever made, you know, like Rain in Blood. How long is that? You know? And, I just didn't. So, but, we did have extra material. So, there was something to do with this, the length of the 10 inch sides and how many songs. And, but I also, I think part of it was to have it, you know, vary, you know, have it be something different. So somebody would want to have both. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Sure. And the relationship with AMREP, I believe, still even continues. There was a release as late as 2013.
We've been talking for months about he wants to do a reissue of the 30th anniversary of Strap It On, and the Universal is this big lumbering, slow-moving giant, and Hayes is like, no wonder they can't make any money. They sent some agreement, and we hope to get it out by the end of the year, because it's this year's the 30th. It came out in 1990. So
all the rights start reverting back to you at this point. Is that correct?
Eventually, yeah. I mean, my publishing, I sold it. You know, I got signed a publishing deal with Chrysalis, which was a mistake, because I'm super loyal, and my guy was let go at Warner Chappell, so I lost a lot of money by going with him, and now he's somewhere else and didn't sign me to a publishing deal. So I'm like, I lost literally like $350,000 or something I left on the table.
So with AMREP, is it still kind of a handshake 50-50 deal, like the invasion?
Yeah, it's per you know, per release, if we're going to do something. We did something, a split 7-inch with the Melvins when we toured Australia together. And we did a, I forget what the Stuck, the song Stuck, I forget what that was for, why we did that with Hayes. But Hayes is a great, great artist, and he does this really cool artwork. And we're still, he's, I still love him like a brother. I mean, he's a great friend. And we had, you know, we had lunch together when we played Minneapolis, and he's too much of an old fart to make it out to the show anymore. He's like, all right, hung out with us most of the day. But then he's like, are you cool if I go home? It's like, hey, man, after 7 o'clock, I don't want to leave the house. I'm not going to see a rock show. Hell no. You know, if John Bonham comes back from the dead, maybe I'll go do that. But like, otherwise, no, sir. Yeah. I want to be home. I want to be home with my, you know, guitar in my lap and watching reruns of Law and Order or whatever.
I know when you're young, you want to be up near the front of the stage. I'm now slowly over the years, you go back and back. I'm now the old punk at the back of the room. And the next step is being out of the building.
So. Yeah, it's tough, man. I go see the LA Philharmonic about 6 times a year, but that's a whole different experience. I'm like, oh, I gotta drive to downtown LA Disney Hall, but then once you get in there, it's like, oh God, it's just heaven. And I always leave about 3 feet off the ground. But to be honest, I mean, at this point, I haven't heard anything, you know, in rock music, electric guitars, that I just go, holy crap. I mean, I don't remember the last thing I heard, and I was like, I gotta see how that sounds live, you know. I mean when I played a couple songs with Wire, and they sounded phenomenal, as they always will. And I did see David Byrne about 10-12 years ago, and he was amazing. And I think certain things, maybe it's just what I like, but I can hear a band that's got the whole retro thing that got so popular, that you know, like the 70s vibe, that sound, everybody taking ZZ Top kind of. And I go, I played with ZZ Top. I've seen them. I don't need to see somebody that sounds like ZZ Top, but, you know, because nobody's Billy F. Gibbons, you know. Yeah. But I just can't do it. I don't know. It's too much. You know, in LA, you got to get in your car and drive so you can have 2 beers. And then, you know, then it's like, okay, now what do I do? You know, it's sad. It's sad.
Yeah, yeah. It is what it is. At least you're around. The alternative to not being around isn't very appealing either. So
exactly. Yeah, yeah. That's what my mother said. How you doing, Barb? It's like, oh, shit, I'm okay. It's better, you know, better than the alternative. I'm like, yep.
So you did a lot of studio work, some credited, some not credited. You played on The Fragile. You did a lot of work with Trent. Was there any involvement in the Tapeworm project?
I don't really know what was what when I was down there. I went down so much and so often. And Trent is so generous I love the guy. And I think what he did is some of the most interesting stuff of my peers, you know. And he was always really, really trying, you know, trying new things out and stuff. And just when I was talking to Bob, Alan Mulder. Sorry, I almost said Bob Mold. I was like, Alan Mulder. I was like, does anybody know how to operate all this gear in the control room? He's like, yeah, probably Trent's probably the only one. I mean, that control room in New Orleans was just wall to wall, vintage, cool stuff, newer stuff, everything you can imagine. And he's got this, I would come in and jam with him. Then I'd do stuff with Charlie in Charlie's room. They taught me how to use the computer. They set me up my own little studio room and turned me on to Logic Audio. And it's basically like, you know, camp. And it was really fun, you know, but, I don't know what made it where. I know Keith, one guy that was one of Trent's programmers, put out a sound DVD, like a you know, you can buy like
a license sample library sort of thing.
Bought like the scoring bases from Native Instruments, and I bought the Evolve Mutations or whatever, cool sounds and things and loops. And I know he made that and he used a bunch of my stuff, but I never got a copy, and I never heard what you know, what they used it, you know. So I'm cool with it, because I loved being down there, and I learned a lot, and just was a, you know, Trent was like, stay as long as you want, I love having you here. And Clint Mansell was also there. His budding film career had just started because he just done Requiem for a Dream. Mm-hmm. We actually all went to a screening of it in a New Orleans theater. It was really fun, just me and the Nine Snails camp. But I don't know what's – I know I did something on a Dre thing, and I never heard what they did with it. It was – I took kind of one of his drum loops and I did superimposed an odd time signature. It was really cool. I recorded it with Charlie Clouser and – I sit down and said, Jimmy, did they ever do anything with that? And he's like, oh, he has to quantize it or do this or do that or whatever. I'm like, yeah, right, whatever. It's like, I'm sure he can't afford to pay me. So it was cool. And then I was getting calls to go play on Brandy albums or whatever. They played it for everybody at the label. And I was like, oh my God. And I was like, no. I'm not doing this. I have a different thing. Tommy Lee called me once and wanted me to play, join his band, and I like him. He's a really nice guy. But I was like, no, I got my own thing, And Serge from System of a Down, I came in and listened to his solo stuff early on, and he wanted me to play guitar. But I'll do something to guest. I guested it on the Linkin Park thing. It was really fun. Mm-hmm. They were gracious and, really good guys. And but it's just, I do need to continue to sort of push my own thing forward. It's kind of what keeps me from going crazy,
Well, it continues to really, the momentum continues. I mean, you're still doing these large festivals. You're on the bill with Faith No More, System. It seems the demand for Helmet continues to grow.
Yeah, the 30th anniversary tour was the biggest tour we've done. And I think it was bigger than tours from back in the day. It was awesome. We sold out, and like this Australia, New Zealand thing coming up, sold out Melbourne and Brizzy so fast that we had to add shows. And then they were throwing a fit, Newcastle and Perth. So we had to add those shows. And it's good, it's like, but right now I'm in the middle of, not in the middle of, I've done most of my cues, but I'm scoring a movie called Painted Beauty that was shot in Hong Kong, and I'm playing guitar on the epic teen romantic drama Kissing Booth 2. If you didn't see Kissing Booth 1, I'm all over that thing, and that was so big. It was the biggest movie Netflix did apparently 2 years ago, and so they've shot 2 and 3, and I'm on I think the first guitar note you're going to hear is me. I've been fortunate to play like the first note in that Julie Taymor movie, the Beatles movie. What the hell, why am I drawing a blank? Across the Universe. The feedback on the beach is me, you hear. So there's, I've done probably about 15 or 20 movies with Elliot Goldthal. I love him. He's changed my life, and I love his whole team of people, and his, Julie is his wife, and she's great. I've done her movie Titus, and Across the Universe, and one other one, The Tempest, I did. So that stuff's really, really fun for me. And then I'm heading to Nashville to work with middle school kids, which I love doing that. And I also got commissioned to write a piece for the Christian Brothers High School in Memphis, their 150th. It's the oldest high school band or orchestra in America. So I'm going to write a piece for them for 2023. And I love doing a variety of stuff, but Helmet kind of keeps me sane. You know what I mean? It's like, cause I get to, you can let out a lot of steam on stage. It's really great.
Well, it's fantastic. You still get all those opportunities. That's it's exactly why you want to protect your hearing, Paige, so you can continue to take advantage of that.
Yeah. Cause that string quartet's going to be interesting if I'm deaf, but look at what Beethoven did when he was deaf, gosh.
So look, I'm going to start wrapping it up. Paige, is there anything you want to talk about that we haven't brought up?
I can't think of anything. We have this 30th thing continuing down in Australia, New Zealand, Tasmania. Finally, we get to play. I had to cancel Japan, unfortunately. In the Philippines and China, we are on hold. Those were being discussed for obvious reasons. So I'm just hoping everybody's okay and we come out of this. And I love doing this. And we're releasing 4 7-inch cover songs over the course of the next year. We did a Bowie cover. That's the first one to come out. We recorded them years ago, and they just were never released. And I mixed a CBGB show and a Big Day Out show, live shows that are very, very, very raw.
When are those coming out, and how can
I don't I don't know. I've asked them sort of like every 3 or 4 months, what's going on with that, and are we ready to make a new album? I'm ready to make a new album. So I have some I'm meeting with some people tomorrow about doing a different kind of album, because my vocal guy that I work with, Mark Rink, works with Tony Bennett's daughter Antonia, and I had lunch with her, and so we're gonna do a duet, which I think will be really interesting. She's a, you know, kind of following her father's footsteps, and it's more of a jazz singer, and it's something I've been fantasizing about for a million years. So,
Well, again, Paige, thanks for coming on the show. I want to remind folks that Helmet is coming down under. Tickets are selling out in most of these places. If they're still available in your town, get them now. Go to helmetmusic.com. There's a little tour link. You can click it there. Also, check out Helmet's, I guess this is now, it's not new, but the most recent album, Dead to the World. It's a solid set, and it sounds like there's going to be more stuff coming. Paige, thank you so much for coming on the Vinyl Guide. Much appreciated.
I appreciate it. That was great. I'm glad we were able to make it happen.
All right, there we go. Ladies and gentlemen, Paige Hamilton of Helmet. What a band, and what a nice guy. Let me just remind you, if you want to hear the other half of the conversation, go to patreon.com/vinylguide. Join our community and get access to the other half of this conversation, a bunch of exclusive content, extended interviews, secret episodes, and heaps more. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. And also make sure you check out helmetmusic.com or facebook.com/helmetmusic. Check out the new dates of Helmet's tour. The 30 by 30 tour down here in Australia is now in November. A bunch of dates with Faith No More and other festivals are listed up there now. So it looks like we're going to be rocking out with Helmet right after this COVID crisis. Again, helmetmusic.com or facebook.com/helmetmusic for the latest dates and tour info. And that is it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. And I get a lot of questions from people asking what they can do to help support our show. Besides listening, you can always join our Patreon subscribers at patreon.com/vinylguide. And if that's not an availability, then just share these episodes. Put them on your Facebook, tweet them on Twitter, share them on Instagram. That's a huge help too. So please help spread the word of The Vinyl Guide podcast. And we'll be back with a brand new episode shortly. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.